Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's November 30th program, What Do the Midterm Results Tell Us? Reflections on Elections. Thanks to Mary Layton for coordinating this program. This is the 12th program of our 2018-2019 programming year. I'm Joel Corin, President of City Club. Support for City Club is provided by our members and our sponsors. You can become a member or become a sponsor at cityclubofeugene.org. We have both business and in-kind sponsors. Our diamond sponsors are Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care and to improve the health of our members and communities we serve. More information at www.kp.org. And our new diamond sponsor, the University of Oregon. Since 1876, the UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. And our Sapphire sponsor, Summit Bank. Summit Bank supports City Club, and it is your local community bank, an independent community bank headquartered in Eugene. Summit Bank serves businesses and professionals in Eugene, Springfield, and Central Oregon. Learn more about SBK from sbko.bank. Our program, since November 7th, almost all the votes have been counted. Runoffs have been held. We learn the names of the winners and the losers. The decisions about what ballot measures were supported or defeated. What do the patterns of wins and losses mean? Is it a blue wave? Is it a light blue wave? What is the significance? What can we expect in the coming 2 years in Oregon and in the country? In this program, Professor Priscilla Southwell will tell us what she thinks about the results. Dr. Southwell is a professor of political science at the U of O and arrived here in 1981. She is the author of more than 70 articles and book chapters on political parties and elections, primarily focused on European and U.S. politics. In 1996, she was named a National Science Foundation grant to examine the effects of vote by mail in Oregon. She previously taught in UO study abroad programs in France, Italy, and England. She couldn't get out of town quick enough. She served as an associate dean in the social sciences from 2001 to 2008 and as department head in 1998 to 2001 and 2010 to 2016. Her most recent publications are Governing Oregon, Continuity and Change, published by OSU Press, with co-authors Edward Weber of OSU, Richard Lucas of PSU, and Mark Henkels of WSU. Dr. Southwell.
Thank you very much for inviting me and allowing me to have the opportunity to talk about political parties and elections. Once again, my favorite topic. So, in the task of what have we learned from the 2018 elections, I'll start out by being a little negative and saying we have a lot more to learn about how to conduct elections. It shouldn't be so difficult to register to vote, and it shouldn't be so difficult to vote. We are in Oregon very, very lucky, but there are a lot of other states that are, or potential voters who are not so lucky. And I understand that Senator Wyden was here a few weeks ago to talk about his proposals to make vote by mail an option easier for other states to adopt, and I certainly will applaud that. But there's a lot of other things out there that happened on November 6th that I think are troubling. I just think it's no way to run a railroad when you have to wait in line for 4 hours in inclement weather or extremely hot weather, and then to find that they've run out of ballots or that the voting machines don't work. I mean, you've all read this, you, I'm sure, read the New York Times, but it's just, it's amazing. I think if another country in Africa or Europe or whatever ran elections the way we did and had these kind of problems, we'd go, oh my gosh, they don't know what they're doing. Let's send in the observers. So we have a lot more of work to be done. I mean, in that note, I can only say that I think maybe we need to have the federal government be a little more forceful in saying to states and counties, you have to have some minimal requirements for what a polling place looks like, if you're so backward as to have a polling place. Sorry, that was a little too harsh. But anyway, it seems to me that somebody has to intervene, and it's not just Broward County or Palm Beach County or the state of Florida. These problems occurred in far too many states, and I think it should be an integral right of a potential voter to be able to have some certainty when he or she goes to the polls that they are actually going to be able to vote. I know I'm sort of preaching to the choir here, but I think it's enough is enough. Granted, early voting and vote by mail have been adopted by more states, but again, there's more work that could be done about early voting. Some of the states have curtailed the days and the times in which early voting is allowed. Why, I don't know. I actually think even there's some improvement that could be done with vote by mail to editorialize. I think it would be nice if the state had enough money that our mail-in ballots actually had prepaid postage. I have 4 adult children, and I don't even think they know what a stamp looks like. And so that is a problem. I mean, they obviously vote because I scream at them. But I think it's something that is not a common thing to do, put something in the mail. And we all know you don't have to mail it, but then you have to find out where the nearest drop box is. So that's something that even Oregon, I think, could do. I also, to take a dig at our neighbor to the north, I actually think it would be nice if the state of Washington required that the ballot get in on election day and not just be postmarked, because it does delay the results and it makes it really uncertain for anyone wanting to know what's happening in Washington. So anyway, there's always room for improvement. I would also, to be kind of negative, and I'm sounding like the Washington Post, we have some problems, not just with the Electoral College, I won't get started on that, but there is a problem with the Senate. And did you know in this last election that more people out there voted for a Democratic senatorial candidate? And look what happened. And the same thing happened 2 years ago. So we all know the reason why, because Wyoming has 2 senators and so does California. But it would take a constitutional amendment, and I can't imagine what the possibility or the chances of it passing. But it is a little strange that we continue to do this. So I guess what I'm saying is that the 2018, 2016, whatever, elections say to me over and over again, we could be a little more democratic with a small d. The House is a little bit better, but it's in this election, for example, more people voted for in their U.S. House race, voted for a Democratic candidate, and then what happened? But that happened 2 years ago, too. So that's not due to Wyoming having 2 senators, it's due to good old gerrymandering. And the Supreme Court has kind of punted on this, at least for a while. So gerrymandering is a problem, and I'll talk about it even in terms of Oregon. All right, so on a more positive note, 2018 was the year of the woman. Maybe you remember 1992 was also called the Year of the Woman, but we have surpassed in many ways the record set in 1992. So as of counting, there's still some races out there, but there will be 100 plus women in the U.S. House, which is the all-time record. And a lot of them are newly elected, and a lot of them are people that had never run for office before. So it's pretty amazing. And a lot of them, I don't know if you read more about this, a lot of them had a great deal of difficulty raising money, more so than their male counterparts did, partly because they were probably first-time candidates or first-time even getting involved in politics. And this will change now that we have so many incumbents, but it is a burden. Most of them were running as Democrats, and so in terms of what I would urge for the, I'm going to go after the Democrats too, but what I would urge the Republicans is they need to recruit more female candidates. They tend to do quite well. Now, so again, let me just read off the list of also not only the numbers of women, but who were these women. The first Native American woman, 2 of them, were elected from, one from Kansas and one from New Mexico to the House. The first 2 first Muslim women elected to the House, both from Minnesota. first female senator from Tennessee, who was a Republican, first female senator from Arizona, first Latino woman from Texas, first female governor of Maine, first female governor of South Dakota. So, first African-American woman from the state of Massachusetts, the same thing with Connecticut. And Ocasio-Cortez, who just amazed everybody by beating the Democrat incumbent in the primary. She's from Queens, Brooklyn, who had been in office for over 20 years. And so she is the youngest woman ever elected to Congress at 29 years old. A lot going on there. Now, we don't always just care about gender. I think we care about parties and policy positions as well, but it was a remarkable year. All right, so what, as I said, I think the Republicans should recruit more females as candidates. All right, the other thing is I think the Democratic Party needs to develop a rural strategy. They obviously did quite well in the suburbs. The suburbs are kind of the swing vote out there, and we saw that in many close elections and even ones that weren't that close. So we know urban voters tend to vote for the Democratic Party. We know that rural voters tend to vote for the Republican Party, but if the Democrats want to have any ghost of a chance of regaining the Senate, they have to recognize that they're going to have to reach out to these rural voters, many of whom are in a situation that should appeal to the philosophy, the basic philosophy of the Democratic Party. I happen to have a brother that lives in North Dakota and a sister that lives in Missouri. And they said, these two women lost because they didn't do enough for rural voters. These are people that basically have inadequate access to health care. Most women have to drive 60 miles to have a baby. There's a whole strategy that people have been talking about, but they haven't done it. Something has to be done about the opioid crisis, real progress on that. People probably need to have more access to things other than talk radio. They need to have a smart broadband. My sister says that teachers in rural Missouri are paid so poorly. Now, obviously the cost of living is lower in rural areas in Missouri and South Dakota, but it's not made up for by that, and it's very difficult to get and keep good teachers. So, as I said, these people and their plight, a lot of them have gone to the Republican Party, and a lot of them voted for Donald Trump. If the Democrats want to nudge that a bit, they have to actually start paying attention to these people, even if they're very few in number. Okay, so on the issue about, I forgot one thing about the gender issue, the gender gap. I don't know if this is good or bad, but the gender gap continues to get wider and wider. So 59% of women voted for a Democratic candidate for the House in this last election, and 40% voted for Republicans. So the gap is now a 23-point difference. And so it's just something to think about, and I think that's one reason why I'm nudging or urging the Republican Party to pay attention to this. All right. I want to talk a little bit about Oregon. Some of this you know well, but turnout was respectable. It was a little bit lower than it was in 2014, so it was 69.5% as opposed to 70.9% in 2014. And of course, in the presidential election year, this is among registered voters, the turnout was slightly over 80%, which looks really, really good, and it has a lot to do with vote by mail. Some people have argued that one of the reasons why turnout went down slightly in 2018 is that because of the good thing, the automatic voter registration, because if you know how this works, if you just go to the DMV to renew your driver's license, you are automatically registered. And so if you're a first-time registrant and that's the way you become registered, you're a little bit less involved in politics and committed, but you're now included among the denominator which is used to determine turnout figures. So I always knew that it's going to go down a little bit just because there are more potential voters and so on. All right, there were no change in the House incumbents. And this is one thing I wanted to emphasize, especially as it looks as if after the 2020 census that Oregon will get an additional U.S. House seat. That's what the projections are. Of course, they said that prior to the 2010 census, and we just missed it by about 40,000 votes or so. But the population trends are suggesting that we're going to have a sixth district. It's going to be very interesting how that comes about. And I'll be controversial about this. If you look at the results of, I don't have them for this particular election, but if you have them, I have them for 2016, 2014, and whatever. For House races, again, this is sounding like the Senate, between 41 and 42% of Oregonians voted for a Republican candidate for the U.S. House. But what's the percentage of seats that they have? 20, one out of five. And why is that? Because it's actually kind of mutual gerrymandering. Most Republicans are in the rural eastern 2nd congressional district. And so they vote for Greg Walden over and over and over again. But in political science terms, that means there's a lot of wasted votes. And then they look at the other four districts, and there are some, obviously, Republicans there, but they are solid Democratic seats, and I'm not surprised that there is no upset or anything, and there won't be for a long time. Where is the 6th congressional district going to be? And is it going to be carved in a way to make it more competitive? In Oregon, we let the state legislature and the governor and determine our redistricting. I don't really like that. I have done research on this. Most of our neighbors in the Progressive West have a commission, an independent commission, that determines the new district lines, and it makes it a lot less partisan. And the research that I did with our former graduate students showed that in all of those states that have an independent commission doing the redistricting process, the result is districts that are much more competitive. Now, do party leaders want to have competition? Not really, they just want to get reelected. So that's why I think it would be good to take it out of the hands of politicians, and because they do obviously have to think about self-interest, they do want to get reelected, but it's not necessarily good for all those people that might want to have a little bit more of a choice in whom they vote for. All right, the other thing that I think is pretty important, this is again Oregon, it's time to have some campaign financing laws that apply to state candidates. We have them for federal candidates. They're very, you know, these are direct contributions. It's, you know, $2,700. If you're actually giving to someone in a federal race, we all know that independent expenditures are where most of the money is, swirls around in a particular campaign. But nonetheless, in Oregon, I mean, it broke the record this year, and by a lot. So $38 million. And the previous record was not that long ago, in 2010, it was about $18 million. So that was the Dudley Kitzhaber race. So something's happening here, and you all probably saw Kate Brown's proposed budget, and she does talk about campaign financing reform, but it's been talked about for a very long time. And I think when Common Cause comes out and criticizes Oregon, then we should sit up a little bit straighter and say, let's try it again. It's probably going to take a constitutional amendment. It's probably going to take a ballot measure that will reform the Constitution and say, we didn't actually mean this was freedom of speech when we said you can only give $2,700 or whatever the amount is. So it's a big, big issue. Ballot measures, I mean, this is not surprising. Only one of them, the on affordable housing, passed. I think this is actually very typical that if you look over the history of ballot measures, whether they're legislative referendum or initiative referendum, they pass about one-third of the time. I can't say too much about 2018, except that the one that did pass was a positive measure. It was a measure to try and get something done. And that is actually, those successful measures over the years are usually ones that say, we want to do something rather than we want to prevent something from happening. So I think that's maybe a slight lesson there. I do not know about a lot of things. I do not know what the result of the supermajority is going to be like in the Oregon State Legislature. Everyone talks about how this is mean we're going to have some kind of tax. It's probably going to be, you know, a gross receipts tax. It's not going to be a sales tax. That's failed 9 times in Oregon history. So, but I think that's at least what the Democrats are planning. They do have this very comfortable majority, but as the Senate President said, Peter Courtney said, we're not going to play it too hard here, because we know that they could just decide to stay home and we wouldn't have a quorum or we wouldn't be able to get anything done. I'm not sure the Republicans are going to do that, but people have done it in the past in other states. But it will be an interesting state legislative session. And so what do I not know? I have no idea. We won't know for a long time until we get something better than exit polls. This is back to the national scene. What impact the Brett Kavanaugh hearings had, nor do I know how much the Me Too movement had, nor do I know how much Donald Trump affected how people voted. The exit polls, and again, exit polls are so suspicious now. Like, how would you do an exit poll in Oregon? There's nothing to exit from. But anyway, so we're ignored by all these exit polls. But the exit polls do suggest that of the people who went to vote, more of them were disfavorable to the Kavanaugh confirmation. But does that mean they're motivated to that's what motivated them to vote? I don't know. Turnout may have been affected by all of those factors. But again, I'm a social scientist. I have to wait until we get some more reliable survey data or in-depth interviews, et cetera. So that's a wide swath over, and I'm sure I've left a lot of questions unanswered and things that I myself have no idea what is going to happen, but it was an interesting ride. So questions? Okay.
Thank you. To follow up on one point, I heard Senator Manning this morning, and he is going to introduce a bill, or has introduced a bill, to provide prepaid postage.
Oh, terrific.
So, see? You ask, and you shall receive.
Yes, immediately.
Our first questioner is Tom Bowerman. Tom's a researcher and project director at Policy Interactive, a nonpartisan interdisciplinary team of researchers working to understand the general public opinions while testing policy alternatives in a variety of areas. He is a member of City Club and one of our most recent turtles. Tom?
Thank you. Thank you, Patricia. That was a very nice presentation. I take it from some of the things that I heard that you have kind of a Democratic lean philosophically. Full disclosure, I'm a registered Republican.
Okay. I'm a registered Democrat.
the Republicans that I might be interacting with at the legislature would call me a rhino. You're not really a Republican. You're just wearing clothes that you're trying to look like one. However, my father was a Republican, a progressive Republican, when there were progressive Republicans, and my grandfather was a Republican. So I'm following something in a family tradition. Although I have switched back and forth between these parties to where I think I can make the most mischief, perhaps. My question, I was listening to NPR this morning. Maybe some of you heard the interview that the commentator had with Claire McCaskill, the senator of Missouri. And I thought it was a really interesting interview, her outtake on being defeated and the condition that happens at the federal level. And she made one comment with respect to the presidential election, but in some respects it applies to her and other people who either win or lose. She says the electorate is very fickle and it likes something shiny and new. It gets tired of the old, and it especially likes people that promise that they're actually going to do something. Whether or not they actually do it, she said, is another matter, or what they do. However, turning attention, because our research is largely in Oregon, my curiosity goes to the trending that we see. The Democrats picked up some seats, I think four in the House and one in the Senate, so they solidified. Technically, we would say they both chambers have a majority or a supermajority, barely in the Senate. The consistency of addressing a progressive agenda in Oregon has something that has swung back and forth like a pendulum. And the work that we have just released publicly in the last couple of weeks, we call it the Oregon Political Typology, We interviewed 1,200 people and studied 1,103 of those because we threw out some just because of issues with respect to polling validity. And in there, we found that the bookends to the political spectrum, the solid liberals and the core Republicans, total out at 34% of the membership. They tend to be the most active, but they represent a minority overall. We found that the six groups in between, this was an eight-group typology that we had, that we studied, represent 66% of the electorate, and in that, the what we call the progressive Republicans, where I think I probably fit closely, is at 12%. And then we have the disaffected Ds. In that 66% is where it's going to go back and forth when the pendulum swings. And when that happens, the policy agenda for progressive ideals that the majority of Oregonians hold will be whipsawed, rather similarly to what happened in the federal election. My question for you, when you look at the electoral process and the polarization, which is commonly referred to in terms of how polarized we are, we find we're not as polarized as the media wants to represent, nor as the elected officials would characterize. Mm-hmm. How do we maintain, or can we maintain, or can we get where we remove some of that polarity and we get more consistency on addressing what everybody really wants? I shouldn't say everybody, but the majority, the 66 to 75%, when you look at where how much we have in shared values and shared worldviews in terms of what kind of society we want to live in. How can we get beyond where we are in the polarization and address the political issues? You've addressed a couple of them, but mm-hmm. can you go deeper on that?
Well, I do agree that the media likes to tell a story, and I do think that they emphasize this polarization to a greater extent than really exists. But I do think that if you look at the halls of Congress, and maybe even our state legislature, but less so, to me, it's good that parties differ on things. I mean, I think we don't really have responsible parties as they do in Europe and other countries of the world where you actually have a clear-cut platform and policy stances by the party, and it's very different on the other side or the other third. But so I think it's good that the party are distinct from one another. What I don't like in the polarization, and this is of elected officials, is that they refuse to listen to an idea that comes from across the aisle. If it's a Democratic proposal, it must be bad. If it's a Republican proposal, it must be bad, depending on where you are. And it's just so rigid, as if they don't want anyone other than their own party to get credit for doing anything good, even if it's in the public interest to do so. So that's the most disturbing thing, and it shows up not just on proposed legislation or roll call votes, but it shows up on judicial nominations and what's always happened. They will not talk to each other, and I've never quite understood that. And I agree that people are not, the average voter is not like that. They actually can sort of say, we need to do something about X problem, or we need to improve in this way, and we don't care if it's a Republican plan or it's a bipartisan plan would be just fine. It's just a matter of getting from A to B to C. And so I think this is actually an elite problem. It's a problem of the elites and not so much the people that you're talking about. So I don't know what we do. There are senators, and I think actually two of our senators are willing to do that and have been on bipartisan efforts. So I think more of that and encouragement of that would be much better. So I do think about the Republican Party, and I think the Republican governor's candidate, did a really good job of emphasizing issues that were problems, graduation rates, and the homeless, and what to do with PERS. All of those things are pressing and needed to be addressed, and I think he did. I think that is the most successful strategy for the Republicans in Oregon is to be a progressive or at least a more moderate Republican, because when you look at the candidates over the last two decades, they haven't always done that, and they've suffered as a result. So even though Buehler lost, and lost by perhaps a little bit more than the polls had indicated, I think the Republican Party is at least moving in the right track by having someone who is not on the extreme and is not, you know, refusing to talk to anyone that's not in the party.
Thank you. We'll now break for 5 minutes for the people to tables to have discussions and come up with questions. Thank you very much.
Good evening. You're listening to the City Club of Eugene on KLCC. We're broadcasting in HD at KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, and KLBR Bend. We're also streaming online, and you can find the City Club programs on our website, klcc.org. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College.
Before we begin our questioning, I'd like to thank public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Monday night at 6:30, and Community Television of Lane County, cable channel 29, for televising our programs. And our gold sponsors, Evans, Elder, Brown, and Siebert, Homes for Good, Arriving by Bike, AARP of Oregon, and our in-kind sponsors, KRVM, Dot Dotson's Photography, Pack Info, and Simplified Computing. We're now ready to begin questions. Please limit your question to 1 minute or so. Avoid the bell. Ask a question. Don't make a statement. Our first question is Paul Thompson.
Yeah, I am Paul Thompson, a City Club member, and thank you very much for coming. It was a stimulating conversation. I'd like to turn the attention just for a second to Lane County, and specifically to the vote on star voting. I am an engineer. I understood the math in star voting, thought about it for a long time, and I was astounded at how close the vote was. It did get defeated, but it was very close. And I wonder if you could comment on what that says about the interest of people to change how they do something as fundamental as the way in which they vote, or the intelligence of the electorate, or what, you know, what there is. Because actually in our household, two intelligent individuals, we split our vote. And so it wasn't a slam dunk as to which way to go.
Yes, I neglected to mention that. That was a very innovative reform that was attempted, and it did narrowly get defeated. I think it didn't help that the Register Guard said it should be defeated, that it was too drastic a reform to be tried, and that's what people said about vote by mail, remember that? Anyway, and it was very limited in scope of the races that it was going to apply to, so an excellent way to sort of try this. Yes, I think a lot of people are supportive of being more electorally innovative, and we have, whether you like it or not, we have some states with the top two party primaries, which some people like and some people don't like. We just finished talking about it. But I think a notion of a kind of way of ranking so that you end up minimizing it's the spoiler effect, which really does affect how a lot of people vote, and they don't vote for their first preference. And so when you have something like this, it's much more flexible, and it's also a much more accurate reflection of how the voter really wants to vote. So.
Jack?
Yeah, I'm Jack Dresser. My question has to do with who actually gets represented by who is elected. You know, in the 16 presidential election, it was shown that 50% of the voting public identified with neither head of the corporate war hydra. And I count myself among those. 50% don't get to participate in who runs. 50% don't care about it because they say it doesn't make any difference. Secondly, there's some evidence supporting this view in the Gillens and Page study, which you must be aware of as a political scientist, that looking at 20 years of federal policy decisions, almost 1,800 of them, they found that the correlation of public opinion represented in mass surveys had zero correlation with the federal policy decisions.
Please ask your question.
Well, yeah, what's to be done about that? The people elected aren't representing the people.
Okay, young people have to vote more often. Yeah, that's part of it, and it did show some improvement, their turnout in 2018, and it may have been a reaction, but I think we need to try things like start voting. We need to just be more innovative about this. I do think campaign financing in Oregon and elsewhere needs to be dealt with more closely. There's got to be a lot of a lot more done also to a lot of the people who don't vote and are of that are alienated. They're absolutely alienated from politics because they see all this infighting, they see all of this, and I think it just has to, more young people not only need to vote, they also need to run for office, and they need to be a different kind of political animal.
Jerry?
Jerry Smith. I'm concerned in the political process that that the poor really aren't being addressed. The Republican governor and Trump said they would help poor. Republican governor candidate actually used the word homeless. And I noticed in the national elections, the word homelessness was never once used by anybody. And with the fact that we have allowed welfare to completely disappear in the United States, there are more people who are below poverty and in homelessness, just tragic destitution. How come, what do we need to do to get them represented?
Okay, so I'll talk about sort of another, it does involve a lot of money. These people who run for office want to get more and more money for more and more donors, and they say this is necessary to run for office. And so they pay attention to those people. And in the United States, if you're a political candidate, you can't get out of the starting box unless you're personally wealthy or you appeal to wealthy interests. And that's the sort of the reality of how much it costs to run an election, or also the amount of money that's swirling out there in terms of independent expenditures. We could be European. What do the Europeans usually do when Theresa May called for a snap election? 3 weeks. 3 weeks from the time in which you, and in France, for example, you cannot campaign the last, it's actually month of a National Assembly elections. When I was there last, I found that my Facebook was blocked. I could not use it at all, couldn't access it. And it's because they have a ban on political advertising in the last month, and certain members of the French National Assembly were using their Facebook as ads. So, I mean, that's how they do it. You just have to sort of say, this campaign is not going to be a year and a half long. And you're not going to get any, well, I don't know about federal matching funds, but because a lot of them don't use it anymore. Your public financing might help. If you could just break that dollar sign, that link between wealthy donors and expensive campaigns and the reality that these candidates face, I think that would elevate, maybe not elevate the role that poor people have, but at least policy issues that would deal with their plight might have a better audience if you had different types of candidates who could be independent and could do things other than, you know, lowering tax rates.
Okay, I spent the first 29 years of my life in the Chicago area, where one of the models of elections were vote early and vote often. And there was a great deal of enthusiasm for voting in the Chicago area. There are places where the number of votes exceeded the number of voters registered in a given area. So I don't advocate that system for the state of Oregon or even for the rest of the United States of America. Now, you've touched on campaign finance. And an outfit, a family like the Koch brothers, could not exist politically north of the border here, or in most of the European countries that have democratic institutions. What would you say are the prospects for our adopting systems that drastically limit campaign donations and post-campaign donations for political purposes?
I can't be that optimistic about it because of what of the two, or actually three Supreme Court rulings that have basically said the expenditure of money is equivalent to freedom of speech and expression. So with Buckley versus Galileo in 1976, from then on out, it's like, what can you do? You can restrict direct contributions, but you can't, and that's how the Koch brothers, that's where most of their money goes. So it's very sobering to talk about that, but I'll give you a I have to add to the Chicago story because I grew up north of Chicago, and my father went to vote. This was actually in the city of Chicago, kind of late in the day, about 7:30, and he walked in, and those were the days where you walked into the polls and you signed your name, etc. And he walked in and said, okay, I'm here, I want to vote. And they said, oh, Dr. Richardson, you've already voted. And he goes, no, I didn't. I swear I didn't vote, and I demand that you give me a ballot. And they did. And so that's why voter turnout is so high in Chicago. You knew exactly, you know exactly what happened. They did the machine politicians basically said, this person's not going to vote. Here, Joe or Judy, take this ballot and vote for Dr. Richardson. Anyway, so at least we're a little bit far gone from those days. Anyway, I want to also be a little optimistic. This is what happens at dinner parties when everyone is bemoaning politics. And I'll say, let's remember we have made some progress. When my grandmother was born in 1893, she didn't have the right to vote and didn't for many, many years. And my mother, who was born in 1916, well, she couldn't vote when she was born, but she didn't have the right to vote. And Oregon was the one, you know, not before Wyoming, but nonetheless, Oregon was in 1912, gave it. And so if my mother had been born in Oregon, she would have been born with the right to vote. But it did take Oregon six times. Six ballot measures before it passed. Anyway, but there is some progress. So, hi.
Hello.
Our daughters are best friends.
Kathleen Shorak Petty, City Club member since August. At my table, we were wondering, which Democrat would you suggest to run against Trump in 2020? And would this person have a chance at winning?
Got it. I only know this because of the Kavanaugh hearings. I like that Minnesota nice woman, Amy Klobuchar. There was a thing in the New York Times two, three days ago going, is she too nice to get elected? And I think she handled herself amazingly well. But also the senator from Delaware, Coons, also handled himself very well in those very tense hearings. But she was terrific. And she, and you know, if you read the story on her, she has a great record of doing a lot of small accomplishments. And in fact, they disparagingly refer to her as the senator of small things. And she said, it's not small to the people that it affected. She's terrific. So, you know, there are a lot of other names swirling around there. And I'm not going to make a prediction. But I like her, and I like what she's done, and I like the way she sounds. And, you know, sound bites aren't everything. But right now, that's a person I think that is a strong-willed but moderate Democrat.
Bob Cassidy, City Club member. You said at the beginning that the legislators should get a little bit more aggressive in telling the states to change the election laws, and we have many problems in the election laws. The legislators have been elected with this system, and they are going to get reelected with mm-hmm. this system, mm-hmm. they think. What is your suggestion as to what the direction we should go in trying to get the laws changed?
Yeah, I was actually referring, I mean, campaign financing is something that would probably not be best left to the actual legislators because of what you said. But the laws that I was saying should be changed perhaps by the federal government or even the state government have to do with the inadequacy of polling stations and that all the problems that you all read about a few weeks ago. That there's got to be, if it can't be as decentralized as it is now and let counties or precincts or whatever, because they tend to sometimes blow it and they're not uniform standards. The ballot look very different from one another. Those are the kinds of laws that I think might have to take more central and standardized control over it because I just think it's indefensible. Yes.
Hello. My name is Sandra Erickson, and I have a question about socialism. Mm-hmm.
we saw Bernie Sanders do Medicare for All, and there was a lot of talk about socialism. We see that Canada, Iceland, the Scandinavian countries are successful economies. So for people interested in money only, that would be a motivation. And we see millennials coming up and more accepting of socialism. So what are your feelings about that kind of change and the fact that capitalism is driven by money and more people want that part of it to kind of tone down, and the alternative would be a more socialistic approach that would maybe lift all boats, provide a net for people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, many of these examples are not, they're not really socialist governments in the way that you think of it in a pure sense. When Francois Mitterrand was president for 9 years in France, he was a socialist, and he did nationalized most of the banks and then he unnationalized some of them, but he was basically a socialist in a capitalist system. And that's in essence what Iceland and Sweden and Norway and all those countries that do that look more socialist than we are. They have to still deal with the fact that they're in a capitalist economic system. So when the Scandinavian companies or countries are often referred to as capitalism with a human face, so they say, yes, we're in this economic system and we're not going to go the way of the Soviet Union or Cuba, but we are going to at least have minimal standards of living for our citizens. And so I think the healthcare is the one that is most obvious, but there are other kinds of things that are obviously things that we could and could afford to do. I mean, clearly parental leave is absolutely ridiculous in the United States, and it compared to almost any other Western European or Scandinavian country or Latin America. So all those kinds of things are these countries have strong economies, or maybe sometimes they're strong. They did suffer more in the 2008-2009 recession. But nonetheless, they are able to afford this, and they there's no reason why the United States can't do it. It's difficult to maneuver these kinds of things when, yes, you have all the desire for wealth and material goods in the United States, but we can certainly overcome it, and I think we're going to be forced to do it.
Skip Coburn, City Club member. Question from our table was, what might be the impact of open primaries on helping to create or empower a viable third party?
Yeah, I think, in terms of a third party, well, okay, open primaries where independents or opposition party members can vote in each other's primary. I think that is even a semi-close where you just allow independents to go. They can't vote in both parties, but they could go to either the Democrat, Republican, or Green, or independent party. Those tend to result in more moderate candidates, but they also tend to favor outsiders. New faces, whether young or old, new faces within the party. Now, in terms of third parties, in trying to get them more success, I think it's going to take more than just opening up the primaries, because they would still have their own separate primary. Top two, believe it or not, even though in Oregon third parties campaigned against it, third parties are helped because they have a chance of getting into the second position and not be a spoiler. Other kinds of electoral reforms, and there are numerous ones out there. We could, you know, this would be really interesting if Oregon wanted to do this. Why don't we have proportional representation start that. It's really not that difficult. You just, and most of Europe and Latin America uses it. We could do that, and we could do things even in the state of Oregon. I mean, I don't know that people would like it if for our U.S. House districts, we didn't have five districts. We were just one district, and we would choose five people based on the percentage of the vote you got. People in rural Oregon wouldn't be too happy with it, and I don't think people in Portland would either. So, but we could think about it.
Thank you so much for your presentation. It's Ruth Daimler.
Yeah.
And my question is about healthcare for all. I'm quite sure we're going to be having it on the ballot,
okay,
the next ballot, 2020. What are some advice that you would give us? Any good advice or suggestions for getting that on the ballot?
Yeah,
making it a winning campaign?
Okay. political advertising is not exactly my forte, but I think that the whole idea of stories, a narrative of the plight of people in rural Oregon, in urban Portland, and just talking about that. I mean, I read these, the Register Guard has started to have a lot of human interest stories about their plight, and the New York Times has a story every few days about, and you can donate to somebody who's had trouble for whatever reason. And I think that that whole idea of being, telling the story, describing what people, what they have to deal with, is the most compelling way to do it, and don't run any more negative ads. I never watched live TV except during the World Series, and I thought, God, why does anyone vote for governor? Anyway.
John Dolo, City Club member. Rural and urban, can you explain to me why the rural people are mostly Republicans while urbans are mostly Democrats? And also, I've been following politics for a very long time. And I've noticed that, especially in the South, quite often the rural people will vote against their own self-interest.
That's a hard one. And I understand that. Remember, I was saying earlier that when you think if you wanted to have a rural strategy, you're actually dealing with these people that are often living in unfortunate circumstances. And why does the Republican Party traditionally appeal to some of these people? A lot of it has to do with demographics and age, that the Republican Party tends to appeal to people who are a little older. And unfortunately, there's sort of a drain of young people in rural America. If they ever get a chance, they leave whatever town it is. And they go to a university, they get well-educated or educated, and then they say, oh, I'd rather live in Portland than I would go back to SIO. And so what happens is that you just basically have the demographics of these rural areas becoming older and traditionally more conservative. So, I mean, that's a partial explanation, but I think that why rural areas often are people who, frankly, don't like urban people. I mean, I heard this when I went to a conference last month about how the animosity against Seattle in rural Washington is just amazing. People always say, we don't want to be like Seattle. We don't want to do that kind of stuff. We don't want to, it's a polarization, and I think it has to do often with the resentment, maybe it's envy, maybe it's whatever, of urban areas. And so this is just sort of it's unfortunately spiraled out of control. But I also think, and I mean, there's an excellent book called The Politics of Discontent, where a woman actually went around, she's a political scientist from the University of Wisconsin, and she went around, she was trying to understand the rise of Scott Walker, a Republican in a, he's out of office now, but a Republican in a kind of progressive state. And she went around talking to people in coffee shops and cafes, and she was basically, she just predicted what happened with Donald Trump. These people are alienated, discontented, and they don't think that elites, actually within any party, really listen to them. But when you get an outsider, when you get someone like Donald Trump, when you have Scott Walker who's just saying, whatever they're saying, it's the point is that it's like nobody likes incumbents anymore, nobody except for a few, but nobody really likes the status quo, and so they will sometimes latch on to a demagogue or someone who's just saying, I'm going to protect you, the little man, the little woman, the common person. I mean, it's kind of like Huey Long. It's actually George Wallace had an appeal like this as well. So that's why I think we need to sort of change that message.
Can I follow up on that? Is that more on social issues or economic issues?
It's a little bit of both. It really is. Some of it is, yes, that many of those rural areas in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan really did not experience the recovery from the 2008-2009 recession that did Washington, D.C. or Eugene, Oregon. And so they went, why has everyone forgotten us? But they will say, and this is the highly conservative thing, other social groups, women, blacks, Latinos, they're getting privileges that were not. And they're losing jobs right and left.
So. Thank you.
All right, hi, my name is Charlie Loeb. In your presentation, you mentioned several ways in which our democracy is not as representative as it might be. You just heard you propose a solution for dealing with congressional districts or non-districts.
Yes.
The states, of course, have been, some states have been working on a workaround for the Electoral College, which would leave the Senate. And I don't know that I have heard any suggestions short of amending the Constitution for how the Senate could become more representative of the American public or the American voter. Do you know of any, or is it a matter of revisiting what the original founders of the Constitution wanted to do?
I mean, yeah, it is the founding fathers' fault. It would take a constitutional amendment to do that, to change the way basically the configuration of the Senate is. Or I heard another suggestion a few days ago. You could do what the British did and just make the House of Lords irrelevant. You could just say, oh, yeah, we're going to have Senate elections. You're just not going to have any more power, or so on, which I don't quote me on that. But nonetheless, I'm sure Senators Wyden and Merkley would not like to hear that. But nonetheless, it really would take a constitutional amendment. The national popular vote movement, which is maybe what you're referring to in terms of the Electoral College, is a way of getting around having a constitutional amendment to abolish or change the Electoral College. And you know how that works. But it's not always popular, and it has not gotten out of a committee in the Oregon State Legislature. I think it might in this next session. Peter Courtney does not like it.
And our last question.
Hello, thank you. Doug Bovee for City Club. So the question is regarding Citizens United. Mm-hmm. Does it require a constitutional amendment, or is there a law, a bill that, of Congress that could alter the effects of Citizens United?
Well, it's a court ruling, and it's a court ruling that was just like Buckley versus Vallejo. So, I mean, you could have a suit. Somebody could, a private citizen or group could sue and say, we think this is, Citizens United is unconstitutional, but it would have to work its way up through the courts and they'd have to say why. But there's a lot of judicial precedent that, and it's not just those that say, that have deemed that a corporation, a union, a person, that was Buckley versus Vallejo, has a right to use money to, you know, as I just said earlier, and you all know about this. I mean, imagine what I am here. I am talking and I'm giving all kinds of opinions all over the place. Now, suppose, in fact, a lot of you might disagree, but unless you're in front of the microphone or whatever, you don't always have an outlet for it. And some people will say, well, I don't like what Professor Southwell said about elections or about this candidate or that candidate. And therefore, this is the rationale. I want to be able to influence the electoral climate. I have to do it by taking out a TV ad or a radio ad or an internet ad. I have to spend money. I'm not defending that, but that's the rationale of the Supreme Court in this. It's a way that's spending money is also saying, this is what I think. Unfortunately, I think it's going to have to be a lawsuit you just can't always, you can look to the current Supreme Court or a future Supreme Court to reverse a decision. Obviously, we have had Supreme Court decisions reversed. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, but it really is a judicial route.
Thank you. Before we thank our speakers today, a couple of announcements. Number one, next week, December 7th, we'll have a program on the future of local newspapers. Our guest speaker will be Lisa Hayamoto, the University of Oregon School of Journalism. Members, we're starting the meeting at 11:15. We have votes on, 11:45, 15 minutes early. We have votes on a new proposed set of bylaws, some bylaws changes, and we also have an open board seat. There'll be election for that. You've received the information about that in the mail on around November 15th. Check it out before you come to vote. Please get here early so we can have a quorum and get started. And the City Club of Eugene, again, will be sponsoring the winter course for educators, Oh, the Places You Will Go. This is the seventh year of offering the course. Our partners are Lane Education Services District, Lane Workforce Partnership, Eugene and Springfield Chamber of Commerce. The course is free to educators, meets weekly on Thursday afternoons from January 10th to March 21st. You'll be hearing more about it. December 14th, our last program before the break, we will be having Gifts to the City program. More details about that coming up shortly. And now let's thank our speaker, Priscilla Southwell, And first questioner, Tom Bowerman. And thank you for being here today. That concludes our program. See you next week.